Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to WithInsightsRadio.com on the Blog Talk Radio Network, your free online holistic publication resource radio for trusting your intuition, achieving self-discovery, and following your soul self.
Good evening. This is Chief Cloud Pilot once again to Menha Radio. I'm here with Chief Willamutkin.
Hello.
Last week, we kind of had a little bit of a rant over GMOs. It was a lot of fun. This week, I want to talk about the science, a little bit of the science. I'm not a, I'm an amateur geneticist. I like to play with colors and pigeons and tropical fish, uh-huh. And that's about as far as it goes. However, we are advocates of two books, two very recent publications that are helping us to really update or upgrade our knowledge in the herbal antibiotics and antivirals. And something I read in Stephen Herod Buhner's book caught my attention and really got me thinking about the knowledge or the application of, you know, what we know now about how microbes and or your bacteria, your virus, and your fungi, how they adapt to a changing world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and what strikes me in his books, Herbal Antibiotics by Stephen Herod Buhner and The Herbal Antivirals, is that his bibliography is just amazing. I mean, he's not saying, this is not somebody in the, you know, in the New Age healer field. This is not somebody who's talking about, you know, this is happening because of this vibration or that, and I don't mean to denigrate, you know, vibratory medicine, but here is a pathologist, a medical pathologist and psychiatrist or psychologist,
mm-hmm.
a psychiatrist actually, because he's into.
Was he actually a psychiatrist?
I believe so, because he's. I
thought he was just a psychologist.
Well, he's got like 3 doctorate degrees, and they're all in medicine, so you know, what does it matter?
One way or
what
another.
What struck me is that this is a medical man who's off the reservation, who is now teaching things that we should all be teaching. And in understanding treatment-resistant bacteria, virus, and fungus, the microbes that are causing mayhem worldwide with the, you know, the different infections that are now not treatable by antibiotics because of the indiscriminate use of antibiotics, which is something the medical profession predicted 40 years ago, and now we're living it. So, but one of the things he describes in his book, or many of the things he describes in his book, is just exactly how the microbes are able to learn. And that catches my attention because it now, this is now science. You know, we've caught up mm-hmm. to science, who are finally admitting the sentience of the microbe. The sentience of single-cell organisms.
Oh, you're going radical here.
Well, it isn't. This is this is traditional medicine yeah. now. We're not radicalizing it. We used to talk about this, and we were radicals. And we were crazy naturopaths.
Yeah.
Now it's the medical profession. We have to sit back and say, oh, we've been talking about that for 30 years. Nobody would listen. Now we have, you know, the medical profession owning it. It's a little frustrating, mm-hmm. but the way he lines it all out scientifically is very interesting. So this hour and a half is going to be about that. Last week was the rant about GMOs. This week I want to propose a compelling notion that if we start talking about it now, maybe 30 years from now, the medical profession will own it. And, you know, humans might be able to actually look at it seriously. But let's take a look. Let me just regress. I'm going to be reading out of the book Herbal Antibiotics, Natural Alternatives for Treating Drug-Resistant Bacteria by Stephen Herod Buhner. Again, understand that this individual is a medical doctor,
yeah.
medical pathologist, hired by the medical community to find out what the hell. Number one, what is going on? Why are we repeatedly and more unable to treat common infection with the antibiotics? And since we can't, since so many of them are going rogue and becoming untreatable, and within 20 years or so, the Center for Disease Control is actually suggesting that within 20 years or so, 60% of medicine may not be practicable as it is practiced because of the inability to use antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very serious and now things. This is relevant. This is not like the NFL dispute. You know, I'm sorry, this doesn't, you know, who has the bigger IQ? I mean, we're going to start with IQ, I guess, in this presidency, and probably digress to organ size. I don't really care. This is relevant.
I was going to say that was already covered.
Okay, organ size and, you know, yeah, whatever. Buhner talks about how it is absolutely accepted, known, understood that the microbes have the ability to learn. Okay, having said that, let's talk about how do they learn. Okay, they don't sit in the classroom and listen to a teacher and take tests. And no, that's public school. This is how microbes learn. And let's just begin with this. He writes, as soon as a bacterium encounters an antibiotic, it begins to generate possible responses.
Mm-hmm.
This takes time, usually a number of bacterial generations. But bacteria live a lot more quickly than we do. A new generation can occur every 20 minutes for many species. This is some 500,000 times faster than us. 500,000 times faster than us. Okay, so it's understood that organisms can adapt, and organisms do adapt. But it's also understood that it would take, you know, a couple of million years to adapt in a way that is significant to be able to, you know, significant to survival.
Right.
Something observable that's significant to survival. 500,000 times faster than us means that the microbes can do this in a matter of days.
Mm-hmm.
During that quickened time scale, bacteria have found a lot of different ways to respond to our antibiotics. Now, we're going to use antibiotics here as an example, but what I want our listeners to do, Chief, is imagine that if this is what the microbes are doing, we now also have to, by association, we have to come to the point where we admit to the truth that every cell of our bodies also is, at least on some level, sentient,
mm-hmm.
thinks, and has the capacity to learn. That every cell of our body, every strand of DNA, is monitoring itself in its universe and is able to make changes based upon what it sees and observes. The microbes are single-cell organisms that are smart, and so are our single cells in our body, just as smart.
Ranging from the microbiota all the way up to our more complex tissue.
You know it. So let's talk about how Buhner says the bacteria are able to learn, or let's see, to respond to our antibiotics, or to respond to changes.
Mm-hmm.
in their environment, because that's what an antibiotic is.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, we're starting with antibiotics, but I want to get to GMO.
Mm-hmm.
There is a jump here that I'm hoping that I'll be able to make. And, you know, we're going to start with what we now know. This is not what is suggested might mm-hmm. be true. This is not quantum physics. We're not creating muons or gluons or leprechauns or what have you. This is what is known.
Mm-hmm.
This is what is observable science. This is what's replicated in the laboratory. Okay? Bacteria, he says, can decrease the amount of the antibiotic that gets into them. So the bacteria can change their very cellular or their very structure to observe an antibiotic and say, oh, that needs to change. Next generation, it's more difficult for that antibiotic mm-hmm. to get in. And next generation, more difficult, even more difficult. So by the time 2 days goes by, you could have a bacteria that won't let that antibiotic in the cell at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, target modification. Bacteria can alter their internal structure their internal structure, but we were talking about the external structure.
Right.
The membrane that separates itself from a stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
Bacteria can alter their internal structure so that the intended target of the antibiotic won't be affected by it. So they can change their guts, internal structure too. And they've been noted to do this.
Yeah.
This is one of the ways that they become resistant to antibiotics. Bacteria can degrade or destroy the actual antibiotic, even if it gets inside them, by creating antibiotic-specific inactivation or disabling compounds. Bacteria can construct tools to use, chemotherapeutic tools to use against an antibiotic substance. Wow. They often use enzymes such as extended-spectrum beta-lactamases. That's very important because that's also used in recombinant gene therapy, recombinant gene experimentation,
mm-hmm.
programming, and the like. Bacteria can remove antibiotics from their cells as fast as they enter them using something called an efflux pump. Essentially, they create a kind of sump pump that will pump out exactly the things they want pumped out on demand. This is not a suggestion that it's possible. This has been observed and duplicated in, replicated in laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
We know this. Bacteria are super adaptable. Sometimes bacteria learn how to live and prosper in antimicrobial environments, such as in the cleaning solutions in hospitals. Wow. As one journal article put it, quote, contamination mainly by gram-negative bacteria was found in 10 freshly prepared solutions and in 21 of 22 at discard. Sometimes they even learn to use the antibiotics for food. They learn to eat the antibiotics.
Well, crap.
Once a bacterium, he says, develops a method for countering an antibiotic. Now, this is a method for responding to a stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he's using the antibiotic as the stimulus, but what he's actually, and he's being very narrow because his book is about antibiotics.
Yeah, context.
Yeah, it's in context, but take this in the more general context. Once a bacterium develops a method for countering an antibiotic or responding
mm-hmm.
to a stimulus, it systematically begins to pass the knowledge on to other bacteria at an extremely rapid rate. Under the pressure of antibiotics, bacteria are interacting with as many other forms and numbers of bacteria as they can. In fact, bacteria are communicating across bacterial species lines, something they were never known to do before the advent of commercial antibiotics. The first thing they share is resistance information, and they do this in a number of different ways. And he goes on to talk about how they share resistance information. Now, understand, resistance information is an encoded segment of DNA. Okay, that's what he's talking about here. Bacteria encode several different kinds of plasmids,
mm-hmm.
essentially chromosome-independent DNA strands, each of which contains resistance information, and they pass these on to other bacteria. Interestingly, this is exactly the process scientists use to generate GMO products. They use bacteria or virus
mm-hmm.
DNA segments, and they use the actual bacteria or the virus
mm-hmm.
to pass those segments on to the target or the host organism. So what they've done is in observing that bacteria and virus can do this, scientists are saying, oh, we can use that as a piggyback to change traits in a tomato. We can't cross a sea squirt with a tomato. See, they want that because a sea squirt is a gastropod that contains, it lives in very, very cold water. So it
yeah.
contains antifreeze in its bloodstream or in its fluid. So they want the tomato to have antifreeze so that they can have a whole crop more. This tomato can grow further into the cold season, or they can grow tomatoes where it's too cold to grow tomatoes.
Right.
So what they've done is they're using bacteria and virus to create or to take the trait
mm-hmm.
of one species and pass it on to another species, which is exactly what he's talking about here, encoding plasmids. Scientists in laboratory encode plasmids, and then they use the ability of bacteria and virus to transmit into other organisms. Let me read that again. Bacteria encode several different kinds of plasmids, like the scientists in the laboratory do, essentially chromosome-independent DNA strands, each of which contains resistance information, and they pass these on to other bacteria. Plasmids are highly mobile genetic strands and are widely exchanged throughout the bacterial world. Aminoglycosides, for example, some of the most potent antibacterial known, were originally isolated from Acetomyces, a type of bacteria. Those bacteria created and use aminoglycosides themselves to kill invading or competing bacteria. But the aminoglycosides could also kill actinomycetes. So the actinomycetes also created something to deactivate aminoglycosides, and they stored that information on plasmids inside themselves. All resistance to aminoglycosides worldwide, including in Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter organisms, has come from those ancient plasmids created by actinomycetes. So our antibiotics are created out of the ability of bacteria, biotics, to battle biotics and to protect themselves from other biotics battling with them. Okay, we haven't invented these things. We simply observed the bacteria and the virus doing it, and we have copied it in the laboratory for our own purposes. This process is used to create all GMO products. All GMO products. The way that Roundup resistance is developed in corn is by using bacteria or virus to transmit plasmids, DNA strands, onto corn that allow it to resist the effects of a glycophosphate or glycophosphate. My mouth wouldn't work. What the heck? Very strange. Okay, so they also use transposons and integrons. Now, it sounds like your bacteriologists and your virologists are now making up terms. That kind of sounds like quantum physics, doesn't it?
Those terms have been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't... muons and gluons and leptons and... Oh, my gosh. I can't keep them straight. But now we have transposons and integrons. So taking a cue. Bacteria use transposons, unique movable segments of DNA that are a normal component of their genome. Okay, now this is important, that are a normal component of their genome that's movable.
Movable segments.
Right. Now remember that. They're using their own normal genome, and they're moving them around. Okay, they're readily integrated in DNA structures, and when they are, the genetic makeup and hence the physical form of the organism is altered. That's exactly what we're trying to do with GMO, right? Scientists want to change the physical form or behavior of products, of living things that become our food. Bacteria use transposons to transfer a significant amount of resistance information and often release them in free form into the environment. Okay, so bacteria are smart enough to use this process to change organisms so that they're no longer affected by the antibiotics.
Right.
We smart scientists, humans, use exactly the same process with exactly the same organisms to change corn.
Yeah.
To change rice, to change wheat, to change tomatoes, to change. We didn't invent a thing. We simply observed what could be the end of humanity and are hastening the end of humanity by copying it. Okay, that's a personal opinion. But, you know, get this. Bacteria use viruses. Bacterial viruses or bacteriophages also help transfer resistance information between different bacteria species to species.
Yep.
It is now known that instead of making only copies of themselves when they reproduce, bacteriophages take up and make copies of host chromosome segments that contain resistance information, which are then transferred to newly infected bacteria or tomatoes. Well, it's exactly the same process.
A virus wants a suitable nursery.
Well,
so in the microcellular world, it would take segments of its ideal host with it into another host to modify its environment.
Exactly. Which is exactly...
It wants ideal nursery environment.
Yeah, and that's the exact same motive that your laboratory geneticist working on a GMO tomato has. The motive is the same. They're bacteria, they're virus, they're thinking, they're mimicking the behavior of the microbial world because it is so effective. I mean, in proof whereof, I ask you to consider how long the bacteria have been on the planet.
It depends on who you're talking
to. A long, long, even even in the short term, quite a bit lot longer than us.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're looking at something that's proven tremendously effective at all this and saying, you know...
Billions of years.
Billions and billions of years. They're saying, why monkey with that? We know how it's done. All we need is to develop the laboratory where we can mimic or replicate that. And they have.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very, very successful. Okay? So if bacterial learning is something that is... If bacterial learning is something that is well represented now in the medical profession, in microbiology, then we can make some assumptions. And I've drawn some assumptions that have alarmed me. I mean, I've followed some things. The thing about a book like this is that it's all about antibiotics.
Yeah.
And I'm following these same, this same truth. Or the same knowing, the knowledge here is universal. It crosses many disciplines. The one that I'm most interested in is GMO, because these scientists have used exactly the same process and exactly the same organisms to transfer genetic, new genetic material, trait onto other species that the bacteria have used to transfer new trait, rather antibiotic resistance, onto other species other than themselves. So I ask you to follow me in these, you know, in a couple of assumptions. Number one, microbes adapt. They learn, they read their environment, and they learn. And so I've read in Buhner's work how, you know, he's outlined some of the ways in which they do that. Now, one of the highlights, I think, of Buhner's books that I like the most is the bibliography. I can spend as much time in the bibliography as I do in the book itself.
Yeah.
It's one of the only books I've ever picked up on natural medicine that has literally, let's count the pages, page 381 to page 448 is bibliography. And his bibliography cites the research where the things that he's stating are categorically called out. I mean, this is a call out.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote this bibliography so that nobody could say he's full of shit. because he can just point at, okay, so what you're saying is... with respect to that comment, you know, these five researchers in this Stanford University study are also full of shit. And it's over 100 pages then of small print. I mean,
I've got good eyesight and I can barely read.
Yeah, I mean, look at the what do they call that? The print.
The font.
The font is probably a 10, wouldn't you say?
In the book, yeah.
Probably about a 10.
Yeah,
the font of the bibliography is a quarter, a third to a quarter the size.
That's about a four.
That's about a four, yeah. And we've got 100 pages. So in the in the same font that he wrote the book, if he were to print the bibliography in that font, I calculated it, the bibliography is as big as a book. It's as big as the book. So he'd have to have a book that is 3 inches thick. Half of it would literally be bibliography. So what that tells me is the guy really spent 10, 15 years crossing his T's, dotting his I's, making sure that what he's saying is not a bunch of hoopla. It's not repeating some journalistic review. It's not repeating some windbag opinion out of the late 19th, early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some Christopher crap. He's not repeating something that's been repeated and repeated and assuming that what he's repeating is true, because I guess if you say something enough, you own it and it becomes true.
Hashtag yeast overgrowth. No, that's a different topic.
Hashtag Trump. No, if you say it enough, it's true, and you just need to check with us because, you know, we'll say it again and that'll make it even more true. No, this wasn't his motive. I use Buhner because he really checked it out.
Yeah.
And went even further. He's part of the process whereby we discovered these things about the overuse of antibiotics. Let's follow this then. He says that the microbes learn by observing, deep observation, constant observation of their environment.
Generational observation.
Generational, and this information is passed on. Mm-hmm. Now, we also know that a whole bunch, possibly even the majority of our DNA strand is what's known as, air quotes, junk DNA.
Yeah.
It's just there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no reason for me to have on my DNA some of this junk. However, your immune cells know what is self and what is not self. So even though there's a whole bunch of junk DNA, segments and junk sequences on that DNA, on that gene expression, your immune cells know self. They know every single aspect. They have the ability to see their environment, judge just as accurately as any single cell microbe.
Yep.
If that were not so, we would not be able to come into any exotic substance without dying outright. Our immune cells have the ability to learn. Our tissue cells have ability to learn. Our cells are just like the microbes. We're not that far different.
No.
Okay. So there's an assumption that we can make. We can assume, therefore, that our cells have much of the same learning ability as the microbes. May not be able to do it as quickly because they're not reproducible in the same scale and the same time frame as very short-lived organisms. We're long-lived organisms, so it takes us longer.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they don't have the ability that a short-lived organism has. It's just that the short-lived organism can do this millions of times faster than us. It's math. It's not brain size. It's not the difference between the IQ of the president and the secretary of state. It's math, okay?
Like if an antibiotic requires a specific 3 or 4 factor molecular shape, and one generation of bacteria learns the one factor and dies, its data is picked up by the next generation or a similar bacteria.
Right, it's already in the plasmid.
And it may be with that knowledge that next generation or the next 10 generations gets a snippet of the next factor in an antibiotic. It doesn't forget the original factor that was studied previous generation.
It's there.
So by the time you have 500,000 generations within a 20-hour period, no, that's like 20 minutes.
Right.
In any case, by the time you have hundreds of thousands
every
of generations,
20 minutes, it can regenerate itself.
Regenerate itself.
So in 20 hours, you're holy cow.
But you get 20 hours into an infection, and you have, by orders of magnitude, a collective population that just through generational study has made a very comprehensive study of that antibiotic.
And it becomes...
Eventually, it
has the ability to change.
It knows so much about that antibiotic. It knows more than the people who made the antibiotic.
Yeah, so here's an organism that can change its outside, change its inside, create tools, manufacture tools. Okay, so let's jump out of the microbial world, kinda, and into the human arena. The GMO designer. Now, you know, I think of they talk about GMO designers, and these are scientists, These are molecular engineers. They're designing exotic fashion organisms. So what they do is they choose a specific sequence for, they identify a specific sequence of genetic information. They identify it for particular traits.
Mm-hmm.
They say, oh, I want my tomato to be redder. So they take, and I want it to have some antifreeze, and I want it to be resistant to Roundup. So they're going to take Roundup resistance. They're going to take an animal or a plant that is Roundup resistant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Roundup is a defoliant. If we go outside of the plant kingdom, we can find lots of things that can live, maybe not so well, but can at least live through a Roundup spraying. So they'll take a Roundup resistant organism, they'll take a plasmid, or they'll create a sequence, and they will introduce it, not surprisingly, into a bacteria or a virus. The bacteria or virus are known to be able to look at their environment, pick these things up, and add them to themselves. They fill their toolbox. So now the designer has a virus or a bacteria, and E. coli is one of them that mm-hmm. is most commonly used.
Yeah, E. coli, I mean, they can introduce entire sequences over the course of several generations of E. coli, and it just holds on to it.
Yeah. So, okay, now we have a bacteria or a virus, they use both, that has our trait. And it's not going to transmit that trait every time, but there's gazillions of them, right?
Yep.
There's absolutely. If I wanted to find somebody, if I wanted to generate a nose like yours in everybody, I would have to take you and somehow transmit into the population a nose like yours.
Heaven forbid.
I mean, the opportunity to do that is highly limited. It's limited to your progeny, right?
Right. Yeah.
In the bacterial world, you're not limited at all.
No.
You can introduce a nose like yours into tens of trillions, hundreds of trillions, an unlimited number of progeny. Now you've got something. Now you, because mm-hmm. should that transfer just once to a tomato, you're going to have a tomato with a nose like yours. Okay, that's a stupid example, but you get my point.
Uh-huh.
If I want a tomato that's bigger and plumper, redder, and doesn't, and freezes well because it has antifreeze in it, doesn't damage mm-hmm. the cells in response to freezing, I can now ship that all over the world in a way that I never could before. It makes turning the product or turning the resources from the soil into a sellable product mm-hmm. much more handy. And much more, you can make a whole lot more wealth out of it. So there's your GMO designer saying, ooh la la, I'm going to make this tomato with the sea squirt, and I'm going to use a little bit brighter red by using a cuttlefish or some stupid thing like that. And I'm going to use my bacteria now that I have put these segments into, and I'm going to take the tissue of the tomato, and I'm going to introduce this. I'm going to use what's called recombinant gene techniques. Recombinant. I'm going to recombine the genes. Well, they don't go in with some special equipment. You know, they don't go in with a super duper micro scanning electron scalpel and splice these things out.
Are you sure?
No, that is not how it's done.
Darn. Okay? I would love to see that.
That can't be done that way. But what they have discovered is that the bacteria and the virus have their whole toolbox of scalpels with them. Yeah, that's what they have.
Yeah.
And they go in, and if they get one successful recombining, they now have their new designer organism. And that's exactly what they've done. So your viral or bacterial lines are used to carry the trait,
mm-hmm.
you know, a nose like yours, in gene sequences, and they're spliced into the microbial line. They're added to the toolbox of the microbe. We know how to do this. It is so easy mm-hmm. to do. Microbes are figuring out how to do it, and that's why there are no new antibiotics being investigated. There may be one or two where there used to be hundreds in a given year being researched. Now, you know, your pharmaceutical companies are saying, forget that. We're not going to make any money on that. By the time it comes off the production line, the bacteria will be, or the virus will be resistant to it. Nobody's going to buy it. So they're not even, they're not even researching new antimicrobial substances, mm-hmm. really. So now we have these bacterial lines that have a nose like yours, or say the...
Why you gotta be like that?
Well, for... okay, so now we have the microbial lines that have the antifreeze for our freezeless tomato.
Right.
Right? Or our tomato. See, when you freeze, when you super freeze a tomato, the water crystals get real sharp, and they form, and they disrupt the cell so that when you thaw the dumb thing...
They turn mush.
Yeah, you have mush.
Yeah.
So what they want is a tomato that they can freeze solid and then thaw, but it didn't form crystals that will cut the tissue. So here's what we're after, is that antifreeze changes the way the tomato freezes. It doesn't keep it from freezing. It changes the cellular structure of the water, rounds it off so that when you thaw it, you have a tomato. Wonderful idea, right? And it takes a sea squirt to do it.
Well, in the ocean... we see all kinds of creatures that exhibit those kind of attributes.
Exactly.
We even in freshwater, you end up with fish that can be frozen and put right back. If they're not frozen too long, we know of,
we can thaw them and they'll swim away.
Aquatic animals that thaw and swim away.
But here's the thing. You can freeze fish and thaw it, and it's still fish. It's not mush.
Yeah.
Right?
The food is still a viable food.
Okay, so now the carrier is introduced into the host organism. Now, bear in mind, this is a real hit or miss project. If you were to do that, that's the reason I use a nose like yours. If we were to do that with you, we might have, what, a maximum of even if we used clonal lines, we'd have a maximum of a couple of hundred opportunities.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd
yeah.
have to do this with women who are having babies or generate fetus in the laboratory. And no, you can't. This would be impossible, but with microbes, you have millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of noses like yours. So the carrier is introduced into the host organism. The microbial line shares its new information with the new host cells. And if it happens once, you have a new organism. That is how they're making these GMOs.
It's exactly the same thing as bacteria depending on virus and communicating one with another, cross species.
Cross species, that's right. You have a new organism that relied upon a different kind of bacteria, which relied upon a virus. So this is what we're dealing with
it's
here.
It's also the exact same type of process that allows our neutrophil and our basophil white blood cells to take a snippet, take a snapshot or a chunk of some pathogen to a B cell or a T cell. And that little factory that is the B cell and the T cell will custom fabricate an antibody for the antigen.
Well, that's because we have these things are more closely related functionally to the microbes
than
to us. There are those who are saying that, wow, we developed, supposedly we adapted, we evolutionarily, we grew out of the microbes. Some of the things in our bodies are still more microbes than they are people, and they make up people. Okay, so that's where we're at. This carrier is in, the carrier is introduced, the new organism is created, one in 500 trillion, and you did it in a weekend. So you come out with this one. It's in the laboratory, and the target host reproduces the spliced gene segment, affecting the desired mutagenic change. Now let's be clear about that. Once in a gazillion tries can happen in a weekend. So your designer is able to get a tomato that has the trait or closer to the trait he's looking for. And it doesn't take much time.
Nope.
But what you now have is a tomato that has segments of the carrier. It has the trait. The carrier has brought the trait and made the change, but it also has in its DNA all of the latent junk DNA that was added by introducing the carrier. Now, herein lies the dig. Herein lies the dig.
Yeah, because they can pick and choose which traits they want to introduce to the host, but they can't pick and choose how much of the carrier's sequencing is introduced to the host.
Never forget that the tomato lives with some of this bacteria and virus all the time.
Uh-huh.
And so it normally has it. It's not changing the tomato uh-huh. at all. However, introducing that into on the DNA level, introducing that on the genetic programming level makes a significant change that our immune system sees, okay? Remnants of the microbial carrier as well as the trait that we're designing for, the microbial carrier, the virus or the bacteria, remain in the so-called junk DNA of the target host. Now remember, our immune system knows what is self and what is not self. So our bodies take in the tomato, break it down into appropriate sizes so that they can pass the cellular membrane,
mm-hmm.
so that they can feed the cells or can be used as information. Now, I'm here to tell you that food is not broken down to its actual atomic level. Food passes through the membrane in rather large form into the bloodstream. Evidence of this is in what modern medicine calls the chylomicron.
Yeah.
The chylomicron, when you look at blood under the microscope, is a rather large something. It's way too large to be broken fats and proteins broken down to the cellular level. When you look at those under a scanning electron microscope, you have a mountain of stuff to look at.
Yeah.
And you have whole gene sequences left in the chylomicron. The cells can use these chylomicrons immediately. So what they're actually allowing into themselves are huge mountain-sized chunks of nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
The cell further breaks that down through enzymatic process and by cellular respiration, obtains the nutrient that it needs, and the cell respires or expels the garbage, the stuff it can't use,
right.
The waste material. Okay, interestingly, we now have the intelligence, we have the information, we know by watching it that we can transfer cellular material from a trait of some kind from one species to another in the laboratory. And our laboratories are at best clumsy.
Yeah.
Clumsy examples of the kind of laboratory we walk around with inside us, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We don't even understand how these things happen in us. They are so far separated that, you know, we can recognize that one is a laboratory and the other is a laboratory, but the human laboratory is so far, it's light years ahead, okay?
Yeah.
So now, here is something that we have to assume also. Because we know this, the immune cells know what is food, and if a huge hunk of food makes it into the bloodstream, the immune cells are going to attack that and break it down
mm-hmm.
in an inflammatory process. That's a normal process. We know
yeah.
this. A lot of allergies are essentially
mm-hmm.
that happening. Okay. The immune cells also know by observing our cells what is self and what is not, all the way down to the junk DNA in every single cell. It has a snapshot of everything that is right.
In fact, the neutrophil white blood cell may be a perfect example of a cell that knows better than any of the cells what is self. In the neutrophil and the basophil, these white blood cells have multiple nuclei which they can pass on to damaged cells if they have.
The macrophage and the neutrophil are the motile cells
mm-hmm.
that can actually engage in the cellular handshake. And we've watched this. We've actually charted this
mm-hmm.
and recorded this, where one neutrophil will pass information from its body
mm-hmm.
into the body of another neutrophil. This is amazing to watch under the microscope and really compelling. I waste a lot of time looking at these things because it is so cool. But the fact is it happens. Here are tiny, single-cell, almost organisms thinking things that are us. It's part of this interbeing that we are.
Mm-hmm.
And self is the thing that the immune system knows more than anything. when it sees non-self, it carries that information to other, you know, like the neutrophil and the macrophage, they see non-self. Because they can move around and really look at the environment. When they see non-self, they'll run off and they will transmit that information. Mm-hmm. They'll take pieces of the non-self and they'll spread it around. And a B cell, it'll communicate to a B cell, and a B cell will produce antibodies. And those antibodies will break off and they'll float around all through the system. They combine to that non-self and either attract other enzymes, other chemistry to it that break it down further, or the antibodies will actually prevent it from coming into contact with anything else, essentially putting mm-hmm. stilts on it. There are a number of different strategies. So the immune system is that important. And because it's that important, it has to know. It has to know what is self and what is not self. So let's follow this to its logical conclusion then. We eat the tomato with a nose like yours. Information about that nose is transmitted to a joint cell, joint tissue. Okay, the joint tissue has no reason to care, but the information is still there. Mm-hmm. The immune cells know what should be there and what shouldn't be there. They've had millions of years to learn it. Suddenly, there's a nose like yours on that joint tissue. Their job is to work against non-self. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, that joint tissue has something in its very makeup that identifies it, has a great big sign across its forehead that says, kill me, doesn't it? Because when a neutrophil encounters, you know, a foreign body, a sliver mm-hmm. in your skin, it immediately begins to try to break that sliver down.
Yeah.
And in the process, inflammatory processes ensue that do tend to create chemicals that break that splinter mm-hmm. down, or you know, usher the splinter out of the body, cause it to be expelled. The same thing is going to happen. So now the neutrophil, the macrophage are sending information out to the other cells of the body about this new non-self that happens to be seated in the joints. Now we have a problem, because that neutrophil knows what is self but is seeing non-self in self. The neutrophil goes out, the macrophage goes out, transfers the information via the cellular handshake, and B cells produce antibodies.
Custom antibodies for the information according to the data that the neutrophil provided. If that data includes this was not self but has a shape that would ordinarily be self.
It's called an auto.
Yeah.
It's called an autoantibody now. They've created a new word, autoantibodies. Those autoantibodies work to destroy the new self that isn't self. You know, the same thing happens with the T cell. It produces cytokines. Those cytokines and other mm-hmm. a variety of other chemistry work to dissolve, destroy, or cause an inflammatory reaction in the joint mm-hmm. to get rid of those cells, all because some designer wanted tomatoes with a nose like yours. Okay? And that's kind of laughable, but it's so true. I mean, what's the difference between designing a tomato with a C-squirt than, you know, designing a tomato with the fluid from a zit on my nose? There really is the only difference there is the decision of the designer.
Right.
Yeah. The motive and decision of the designer. The same thing is going on. Assumption. Human cells have the same capacity to adapt and change as the microbes do. We came from them. We are not that far removed from them functionally. Mm-hmm. The same pathways are utilized. This is abundantly proven because this is what our designers are using. They're using those pathways.
Yeah.
The same pathways that are in our bodies. It slays me. It absolutely defeats me. It kills me to think that these designers can't think their way out of their laboratory. Here's an example of not thinking something through to its logical conclusion. We now have collateral consequences, mm-hmm. unthought of, unprepared for, irrelevant because it doesn't have a bottom line.
Right.
But now we have a whole medical profession that is scrambling, literally scrambling, because suddenly we have all these new autoimmune diseases. Is it an autoimmune disease, or is it the immune system acting exactly as it should? Absolutely exactly as it should. Unfortunately, the designers of GMOs are also designing humans. When you eat that tomato,
it's a long game.
When it is a long game, and the people who, you know, you can't hold them accountable because they're gone by the time the symptoms occur. So now here's an interesting thing. We have grains that have been GMO'd this way. Couple that with a change in the way we decide to grow the grains. Couple that with all kinds of chemistry that was never found in food. And we have GMO happening in our bodies. We are becoming people who have traits that the immune system doesn't recognize.
Mm-hmm.
This is why there, you know, it may actually, as much as I want to call the gluten intolerance a fad, as many as 30% of people in America are now, to some degree or another, gluten intolerant, but it is not the gluten at all. It is the GMO of the grain carrying the gluten. That is what's going on. The body knows its business.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do about it? Let me just go through the sequence again, see if I, you know, if there's holes in it. I mean, we do this in the laboratory. How elegant is the question? You want to know how elegant the question is before you decide it's a hypothesis to study.
Right.
I mean, you're not going to waste your time and your money on a research unless the hypothesis is elegant enough to see it through. Mm-hmm. So let's go. GMO and an autoimmune disorder study. GMO, the virus carrier gene segment, is engineered into the GMO tomato. But let's call it wheat. Okay? We have GMO'd a wheat capable of carrying more gluten than it was ever able to before. And at the same time, we have GMO'd into the wheat the ability to use a whole lot more of the deadly toxic substance Roundup so that we can cut the cost of producing our GMO'd wheat that has a whole lot more gluten in it. The gluten is changed by the fact that we now have chemical components that gluten never ever had before, and the whole wheat organism is laced with chemical components that it never ever had before. We GMO this thing, and it finds its way into the digestive pathway because now it's a product. It's resources from the soil that have been converted into products. No matter what the consequences are, those products can be sold and will be sold. It's really, really big. It's gigantic.
Stop channeling Baldwin.
There's going to be more money in this than anything, I assure you. Just ask me. I know.
No more radio for you.
Yeah. Finds its way into the digestive pathway. Is taken into the cellular structure by the normal pathway of cellular integration we call digestion. That's how nutrients get into our cells. Okay? At the same time, there's immunological surveillance going on, mm-hmm. and the immune system, the organelles of the immune system are taking photographs. They're writing down names, you know, and taking addresses.
These nutrients, they recognize. This compound, it recognizes.
Yeah, they're taking names.
Yeah.
You know, recognition of the microbial segment is immediately made. The recognition of the new compounds are immediately made. However, they're integrated into the cells. So the connection with the cell, the tissue cell, with the exotic mm-hmm. is made, and that is transmitted through the cellular handshake to innumerable other organelles of the immune system, and the communication is passed, the knowledge is passed, the learning is passed to all the immune system, whereupon, because we're able to adapt, our cells are able to learn, autoantibodies are created to handle the exotic non-self that is in the self tissue, precipitating an inflammatory response. Ergo, oh, you have an autoimmune disease now. We don't know how to fight it. We're just going to give you anti-inflammatories. We're going to give you steroidal anti-inflammatories to help your autoimmune disease, and there's no hope for you. There is nothing left for your life. Yeah. You can do nothing about it. What the hell? This is a failed research.
Yes.
And in every laboratory in the country, when a research fails, the laboratory doesn't just get locked up and everything stay the same. What goes on in a laboratory when a research is finished or fails?
Yellow red tape over the door.
No, there's no yellow red tape. They gut the laboratory. Yeah. It's made ready for the next
research.
Made ready for the next research means that everything having to do with the previous research is removed. Mm-hmm. Everything is washed. Everything is scoured. We need to gut the laboratory. Now, that means that, you know what, we need to kill off the human population and start over, right? Well,
no,
not exactly, because we cannot afford the knee-jerk reaction that says that, you know, we're doomed. We have to continue with the assumption that I wrote down here, assumption number two. It's elegant. It makes this whole terrifying prospect possible. But it is also the thing, and it presents the problem, but it is also the thing that presents the solution. All solutions are found in the problem. Mm-hmm. Here's the assumption. Human cells have the same capacity to adapt and change as the microbes do, and the same pathways are utilized. Okay, gutting the laboratory in this case is doing exactly what so many people have said we must do, and so many nations around the world have already done. We must banish GMOs. We must banish the idea that we can change organism to suit us based upon our commercial motivations. We must banish the idea that designers make good scientists. This is not fashion. You know, when the model walks down the runway and she's wearing something god-awful, nobody buys the god-awful, right? But we're not like that. We troop to the grocery store and we buy the god-awful. We must stop doing that. We must gut the laboratory. We must end the GMO question. Mm-hmm. Now, legislatively, that'll never happen.
Too much money involved.
Oh, my gosh. There's way too much belly in this pork. Way too much belly in this pork. Way too many people are making money. Way too many people have made promises.
Mm-hmm.
No, we got to go to the grocery store, and we've got to make noise. And our noise is generally made by what we buy or what we don't buy. Mm-hmm. The trouble is that Americans especially are the stupidest consumers on the planet.
Now,
we are stupid. We are dumb as a stump when it comes to what we will put in our mouths and call food. I swear to you, that is where we're at. Now, I sat in my office when Suzanne said, it's GMO, it's GMO, it's GMO, and I got this, you know, deer in the headlights look, because, you know, it was somebody, I was, oh my gosh, you know, here's somebody wrapped up in a fad, and it's a magic bullet, and I'm so tired of it. But you know what? When you go down the grocery store aisles, and you read the labels, and you parse out everything that has been GMO, here, do this.
Which means anything that does not say
non-GMO. It's everything. Do this. Go down to your grocery store and put in your basket everything that doesn't say non-GMO that has wheat, corn, or soy. Everything that has wheat, corn, or soy that does not say non-GMO. And I defy, you will not leave the grocery store. You'll become a Walmartian instantly. You will stay there forever because everything that we eat, I mean, there's a reason that we're called corn-fed Americans.
Mm-hmm.
There totally is a reason for that. Everything that we call food, everything that is motivated by convenience, that's in a bag, a bottle, a box, or a can, is loaded. I mean, let's just take corn alone.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to have milled yellow corn to have GMO corn. Everything, the additives are predominantly made from corn. I mean, you even look at the chemical components. So many of the chemical components in food are all made from corn. And it's the same corn. It's all Monsanto, Santo, Satan, Santo, Satan. Somebody stop me. Just kill me now. Just shoot me. It's all, you know, dangerously GMO'd. Recently, there was a beautiful, beautiful field of corn. As you go out of Stockton,
mm-hmm.
right there where you cross the bridge, you go across the Sac River, and there's those big fields on either side.
Yeah.
And there
yeah.
was that, you know, they either have soy, or they have wheat, or they have corn. Down in the river bottom, mm-hmm. it's one of the only places in Missouri you can grow anything in southwestern Missouri. It's in the river bottoms. So we're driving, and there's this gorgeous, beautiful field of corn, and that corn was like 8 feet tall. It was beautiful. But we had a hailstorm, and you could just see where the wind went through this field. It just knocked everything down. It was if it were a painting, it would be like a Picasso, Starry, Starry Night. Everything was just broken over, and it was, you could see the path that the wind took through the field, and the whole crop was simply ruined. There's no way a combine could have picked that corn. So the farmer puts out through the local social media, come and get your feed corn for your chickens. It's free. I'm not going to be able to harvest. I've already collected my insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Come and glean the fields. And so the Amish and the Mennonites and the anarchists and all the neighbors got out with their pickups and they drove to the field. And I had an opportunity to talk to the guy as I was watching people. And I was getting a couple of sacks of corn.
Right.
You know, corn
yeah.
on the cob is good, right? Wrong. And, you know, I got to talking to him, and he mentioned to me that you know, they were big, beautiful ears, probably 10, 11 inches long, thick with kernels,
mm-hmm.
beautiful corn. And I asked him, why did you tell people to come and get their feed corn for their chickens and their pigs? And not, you know, I mean, this is beautiful corn. Why don't you sell it on the roadside? You know, you could sell a lot of this. It's a mm-hmm. highway. You know, he said, oh, no, you don't want to eat this. You want to pass it through something else. So what are you talking about? Well, I didn't grow this for food. This will work for chickens and pigs, maybe to a certain extent your cows. But you don't want to eat this. This is not made for human consumption. And it says right on the package insert for the seed, not to be grown for human consumption. I said, well, why'd you grow it? What was this intended for? And he said, this corn was specially GMO'd to be used in printer cartridges and automobile paints. Printer cartridges and automobile paints. And he says, I don't know if you can safely eat this, but I fed it to my pigs.
And they're
fine. They didn't die. Well, that's exactly what they're doing to us with the GMOs. They're not looking at the unlooked for, unaccounted for consequences of treating us like pigs and feeding us the corn GMO'd to be used in dyes for printers. That's across the board. They're not calculating the consequences
mm-hmm.
of the actions of the commercially motivated GMOs. I was flabbergasted. I was, you know, as the British say, gobsmacked. I'm not sure what gobsmacked means, but I kind of like the sound of that.
Smack in the gob.
Smacked in my gob. Is that a nose like yours? I think it is.
So rude.
I was.
Let's smack your gob.
I was just, I mean, I was wig slapped.
Mm-hmm.
I was totally undone because you know, this was beautiful corn, and I could have fed a lot of chickens with it. But at that point, I wasn't touching it. I got my truck, and I drove away.
Didn't even want to give it to the chickens.
Yeah, thinking to myself, my God, how much corn are we eating that isn't even designed to be food? And what is, you know, what are the consequences of eating that kind of thing? I wouldn't scrape the paint off my car and eat it. I would not shake my printer cartridge ink out into my salad either.
No.
Could change, you know, could really brighten it up, but I'm not doing it. I draw the line. That's commercially.
Toner yellow looks a lot like turmeric.
Oh, great.
Just have to say.
Great, great. Let me repeat the assumptions. Assumption one, microbes adapt. They learn. They learn from their environment. We have taken advantage of that ability to learn and carry that information to other species. We've taken advantage of that. That is how we make GMO organisms. Assumption two, human cells have the same capacity to adapt and change as the microbes do, and the same pathways are utilized. We can change in a very bad direction, ergo autoimmune disease that now has to be treated by the medical profession because they don't know their asses from a hole in the ground. Or they can change in a very good way when we decide to gut the laboratory. When we gut the laboratory, we remove the information. We go back to absolutely good knowledge that the immune system sees. The cells adapt. We can make an absolute, and that's why so often as naturopaths and physiopaths, we can sit a person down who's desperately ill, analyze their diet, and find that they are eating printer cartridges for dinner. Essentially, right? Okay.
Yeah.
It's a nose like yours. And they're eating car paint.
You're so mean.
The analog is so real. You know, they're eating garbage, and we can get them on real food. And they make a complete turnaround, and they regain great health. Their bodies are on task. On task all the time. Every bit is on task as those microbes that the designer engineers are using and know are so effective in creating GMOs. So the question is to humans, do we care? Because when a designer scientist creates a new organism and calls it food for us, but the motive for its creation is to be able to send it from Guatemala to Iceland or Guatemala to Siberia, Guatemala to Indonesia and reconstitute it and still have a tomato with no deference to what it will do to us when we put those gene segments into our bodies. You know, and people still eat that, we have to ask the question, do humans care? Well, the answer to that question is yes, they do. Most nations in Western Europe have banned GMO. Not just this GMO or that GMO. They've banned all GMO. And there's a reason for that. It's not just because they're weird. It's not just because they're European. It's not just because they wear funny clothes and they speak with funny accents, okay? You know, don't do a Donald on this. It's not because of that. It's because they have looked at the science. They have looked at the consequences. The unlooked for consequences in many of those countries are looked for. They have looked for them. We in America, we reach down on the ground. We claw a little hole in the dirt. We insert our head and then we push the dirt in over on top of our head, and that's where we live. Large, in great measure, that is exactly where we live. What we need to do as ministers of the Namenha is call out our members, call out our supplicants, call attention to the fact that they are taking a printer cartridge or toner and sprinkling it out onto their GMO lettuce. There is no difference between that. There is absolutely no difference. And what you're doing is you're predisposing your body to not be recognized by the immune system. Do you want your joints? Do you want your veins? Do you want your arteries? Do you want your tissues to become non-self? Because if that's what you want, keep eating GMO food. Your immune system will stop recognizing you as you, and naturally, because it's an amazing system, a powerful system, naturally, you are going to be sick. You're going to have this outbreak of inflammation that every medical doctor is now pointing out as the cause of everything. I mean, the biggest medical fad right now is inflammation. Mm-hmm. It's not because somebody wrote a book, like some diet book. No, it's real. There is that much inflammation. And they're throwing up their hands and saying, what the hell? We never had this kind of inflammation before. We have no idea what to do with this kind of inflammation. Give us more corn so we can make more anti-inflammatory. You know, we need more steroids. You need to grow more corn so we can make more steroids. That's where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the medical profession is at. So now we have inflammatory index. We have all kinds of foods that we can't eat now because it's got a high inflammatory index. Talking to a sweet lady we met today who has, you know, she's almost panicky about what she can't eat. Her food choices are getting slimmer and slimmer and slimmer because of these published inflammatory indexes. I can't eat that. I can't eat that. I used to eat that all the time. I grew up eating that. I love that, but I can't eat that now because it might cause inflammation.
Yeah.
It might just be the cause of the inflammation. Let me tell you what the cause of the inflammation is. Look at inflammation. What is the thing? You know, you can take a paperclip and, you know, straighten it out and apply one sharp end to your skin and draw it quickly across your arm and watch very carefully. And you'll get a red line if you don't if you don't go too deep. If you go too deep, you're going to bleed. But you'll get a red line, and that's what most people connect when they hear the word inflammation. You can go deeper than that and actually look at what is happening. It is an immune system response. Mm-hmm. It's all immune system response. You have broken cells. Those cells become non-self. You have changed the nature of self cells. The immune system must remove those, ergo, inflammation.
Right.
Do this on a systemic scale by the foods that you eat, and you are doing nothing more than taking a wire brush and scraping it across every single cell of your body. That doesn't sound very smart.
No.
Naturally, everything is becoming non-self because, to be honest with you, when you look at food ingredients, what is non-self? Beef is non-self. Why? I mean,
didn't used to have trouble with beef, but now people are allergic to it.
The beef allergy is freaking amazing. It's one of those anti-inflammatories you can't eat anymore. Red meat. It's not even beef. It's beef, bison, elk, deer, red meat. Don't eat it. Well, the reason is that our immune systems are so confused about what it is that it's going home to mama. Every time it comes in your body, you have an inflammatory process. It's not hard to understand because many digestive processes are inflammatory to begin with. So obviously this is going to be the best used method in the body of clearing non-self. But when you take a cow and you raise it half its life on grass, and you send it to a feedlot, and you feed it what?
Corn.
Monsanto. Cargill. And you feed it designer organisms. Mm-hmm. It's going to become, in part at least, a designer organism, which you now take into your body and expose it to a much better laboratory and a whole lot more designers, not just one who designed a substance and GMO'd the corn. No, we're talking about millions and millions and millions of designer engineers, our immune system, trillions and hundreds of trillions of cells, designer engineers. Assumption: human cells have the same capacity to adapt and change as the microbes do, and the same pathways are utilized. That's what we're doing. We're literally scouring our insides, creating non-self,
mm-hmm.
making changes to ourself without thinking about, you know, down the road consequences.
Mm-hmm.
We have to, at some point, think about the down the road consequences. Unlooked for consequences will destroy our economy, our culture, our ecology, and this is just one small example mm-hmm. of it. In order to produce these designer organisms, we are raping the planet. We are transforming natural resources into designer organisms we call products for sale, and then we sell them to make lots and lots of money without even thinking about how we are murdering our own grandchildren. Nobody thinks about that.
Nope.
Because it's not part of our culture to think about that.
Nope.
It's either good or it's bad. You are rich or you're poor. You have orange hair or you have gray hair like mine. Or no hair. The orange hair especially. Really, really big.
Or you have spiky hair.
Or you have spiky hair because of your GMO product, did it? We need
No, that's totally synthetic. There's no GMO in that.
Okay.
Totally synthetic.
We need to gut this laboratory. We mm-hmm. need to stop putting into this laboratory. We need to stop the experiment.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do as most of the countries in Western Europe and Asia and many of the countries in Africa and South America, we need to do what they have done. We need to ban the GMOs. And if our nation, if our politicians are gutless bloody wonders and are owned and prostituted to their special interests, we still have the capacity to simply not eat the shit they call food. We have the capacity to look Monsanto right in the face
mm-hmm.
and all of their ilk and say, stop. We're not going to buy it anymore. Feed that to pigs. Feed that to something else. We're not going to buy the pigs and eat it. We're not going to buy the cows and eat it. We're not going to buy the chickens and eat it. We're going local. Because you know what? Everywhere in the world still has the capacity to grow local.
Yep.
And that is how we'll gut the laboratory. That's how we'll stop this research. It's failed. It's time to go on. It's time to create a new culture. And that culture begins with putting our feet back into the ground right where we stand and becoming again part of our environment. Go local. Demand local. Not too long ago, well, two Saturdays ago, we went over to the farmer's market. Now, the mm-hmm. farmer's market's going to stop being useful now that we're getting close to the frost.
Right, yeah.
As soon as the frost comes, a lot of those farmer's markets vendors that we met.
Most of them go home.
Yeah, we're not going to see them anymore, but we will still have a farmer's market all the way into November. Mm-hmm. But what we'll see there are people who have bought from Associated Grocers and have put it out on as if it's some kind of farmer's market. It's going to be Walmart out in the parking lot, which sucks.
And if you don't believe it, if you see it and don't believe it, follow them to where they get their food.
Right. You know, stick around. You know, this is not a soundbite. When you're buying food, it's not a sitcom, okay? You do have more than 7 seconds to pay attention,
to actually
watch this thing. You don't have to make your decision in 7 seconds, even though television has taught us that that's how it must be done. You know, the farmer's market, we went to the farmer's market, and that's, you know, we met a few local vendors, and they make marvelous stuff, but they're going to be gone very soon.
Yeah.
Springfield got some accolades in some magazine, and they've been bragging about it for nigh on 20 years, at least 10 years, about being so forward-thinking when it comes to local food. Let me tell you something. In this forward-thinking, award-winning city, we don't even have one truly farmer's market. We have maybe a month and a half to 2 months where farmers sell their wares at the farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the time, it is Walmart on a parking lot.
Yeah, yeah.
This town tried, the people in this town tried a program called A Thousand Gardens. A Thousand Garden program was supposed to funnel good local homegrown food into the school system,
mm-hmm.
thereby reducing hugely the school budget and increasing hugely the nutrition. The city and government made it so difficult that not even 100 gardens were planned, and the program fell to pieces before 10 gardens were planted. Because those gardens, because the food was going into schools, those gardens became food facilities and had to be licensed and inspected.
Yeah. Jeez.
And they regulated it right out of existence in a forward-thinking town. Folks, in all of our towns, wherever we are, wherever we're listening to this information, Nemenha ministers, supplicants of Nemenha ministers, just interested parties, we need to make every single town a source of local food. We can do this. There's a fellow who, with his wife and a few other people, about 15 years ago, went into Jordan. I mean the nation of Jordan. Jordan is right down on sea level in the Mediterranean. Even parts of it are below sea level. They have a net 100% salinated, saltified soil. The water that they grow food with is pumped up out of the soil, the ground, and it is so salty from pesticides and from fertilizer that they have to filter it and then put it back into their food, into their huge greenhouse operations. It's horrible. And so they went in and they were given 10 acres of ground that was perfectly salted.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing grew, and they have photographs of just how bad it was. And they planted a permaculture food forest. They put their feet into that horribly toxic soil that could never grow food again in an area that gets less than a half an inch of rainwater a year. And they built systems in that place that literally captured the fog that once in a while comes off the Mediterranean, gathered dew because of the way they built the land and planted the plants. And they filled cisterns full of water, and they rebuilt soil by natural means, and they had this amazing oasis where they had olives and pomegranates and palm and papaya, and, well, I don't know if they had papaya, but they had a lot of different figs,
and
apricots, and, you know, all kinds of leguminous plants, and it was just an absolute oasis. And the two towns nearby would go in and they would harvest, and they earned money from the olive orchards that were the only ones in the area that lived.
Uh-huh.
So here, everybody else, the place is just it's just barren. It's horrible. And yet here's this little 10-acre oasis, little square 10 mm-hmm. acres oasis that had millions of gallons of water in cisterns below it, that it had captured itself, not pumped up from the ground. Mm-hmm. So this water was clean and pure, and it was literally, as they built the soil literally drove the salt and the residues down, deeper and deeper and deeper until finally they had clean soil growing clean food. Well, the war there got so bad that they had to abandon the property, and they left it.
Mm-hmm.
10 years later, they came back, and they have videos of this. It's called Greening the Desert, and everybody who doubts what I'm saying should download.
Go look for that.
Look for this on YouTube, Greening the Desert and Greening the Desert 2. They went in to ascertain how things went, and they found a food forest still producing all by itself without any care, without any management. In fact, there was some bad management that happened. Somebody took some goats in there and ruined part of it,
uh-huh.
but it was still producing. The cisterns still had clean water, even after all the pumps that they used to distribute the water and the drip systems and everything failed. The system continued.
Jeez.
In the worst possible place on the face of the planet, they produced local food. Under the worst of circumstances, in the worst possible soil, they terraformed a piece of toxic earth
mm-hmm.
and made a Garden of Eden, and it was still there. Since then, the nation of Jordan has commissioned these same people to go in and produce millions of acres. Well, maybe not millions. They planted 2 million trees.
Yeah,
they're producing
yeah.
food forests and local food all over the mm-hmm. nation. That is an example of what we need to be able to do in very small scales everywhere. And if we could do that, we could all turn to local again. We could gut this laboratory, and we need to. The alternative is way too frightening.
Mm-hmm.
Way too frightening. The alternative is the end of our species, and right along with it, numerable other species. That is the alternative. If we do not gut the laboratory and ban, absolutely ban, GMO, then, you know, we, like the designer scientists, are not following this through to its logical conclusion. We are ignoring unlooked for consequences,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think we can do that safely.
No.
I really
don't.
We
can't do it in a clinic.
No, we can't. We cannot call ourselves holistic practitioners mm-hmm. and look, you know, only at a nose like yours. We have to look at the whole organism, right? There is no choice. You cannot call yourself holistic if you're not looking at the whole organism, and you're not trying to get all the information, and you're not trying to use every bit of knowledge that we can get out of a problem
mm-hmm.
to formulate the solution for the problem. We're not doing that. Our culture doesn't teach us that. Our culture teaches we're not American if we do these things. If we don't buy, our culture teaches us we're not American. And you think that's not true, just go back in time and pull down the, you know, the statements made by presidents of the United States. One of them is just, it slayed me when I first heard it, and it just kills me. I will remember it to this day. Bush telling those, you know, the whole nation after Katrina, don't stop buying.
Yeah.
don't save your money. Don't prepare for the worst. We can get through this, but the only way we can get through this is buy. What makes the grass grow? Kill. Don't stop converting resources to products and selling those products and robbing our grandchildren. Because what's most important is the now.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about how we are killing our grandchildren now robs from the now. We can't make our money now and think about our grandchildren tomorrow. That's wrong. It's immoral. It's unethical. And if you cannot stop thinking that way, please do not consider yourself Nemenha. I'm not saying we have to be perfect. I'm not saying we have to change our culture in a minute. But let us begin to think about these things. Let us begin to consider the unlooked for consequences in everything that we do. Let us begin with what we put in our mouths. You have anything to add to that?
We're good.
This is Nemenha Radio. Thank you for joining in with us. This is Claude Pyler and Wela Mutkin. Walk sacred, talk sacred. We'll talk to you next week.